Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Alzheimer's is one of the most feared diseases in the U.S., and yet federal funding for research on the disease is only a fraction of that for cancer, HIV/AIDS, and cardiovascular disease. My guest this hour, Dr. Mervan Singh, says money for research on Alzheimer's is severely lacking. He's dean of the Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences at the UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth, and his lab focuses on hormones and the aging brain. Dr. Singh, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a few definitions, because it's easy to get a lot of these terms mixed up and confused. What's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia to start?
Great question. It's a question we get quite frequently. And dementia is, you could think of as the umbrella term, under which you have several different types of dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, or that represents the largest subcategory under the broader umbrella of dementia. So all Alzheimer's disease cases would fit under dementia. However, not all dementia cases fall under Alzheimer's disease.
And about how many people do we know are affected by dementia and then Alzheimer's?
Yeah. So in the United States, we have approximately 5.2 million people. Globally, we have in the vicinity of 40 to 45 million people who suffer from this disease.
From Alzheimer's
uh-huh. disease. And the impact is getting greater. The projections are such that by 2050, if we don't get a good handle on Alzheimer's disease, the numbers could exceed 13 million and globally could exceed 135 million.
Is there a rise in the incidence, or is it just that we're getting older? As a population.
There's no question that age is the single greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So we are getting older, and because of that, we're starting to see more cases show up. I think our people are also coming forward when they have symptoms of what they would consider dementia. We're still not quite there yet. There's still a pretty good stigma behind dementia, and people might be quite hesitant to approach their physician about the symptoms that they're experiencing, or the loved ones coming forward and saying, hey, my dad or my grandfather or my grandmother is experiencing it. So I think the sophistication of diagnosis is getting better, which translates to more numbers. And also the fact that we are getting older, that also is translating to a greater number of cases that we're seeing.
So is dementia something that everyone gets as they get older, or is it a disease that a fraction of people get?
It is a fraction, but that fraction gets quite large the older we get. So in the younger demographics, you won't expect to see very many people experiencing dementia or being diagnosed with dementia. But certainly after the age, if people live over the age of 85, you can expect one in two people to experience or be diagnosed with dementia. So, again, it speaks to the fact that age is the single greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. But Alzheimer's disease is not simply advanced age. That's an important distinction to make because there are important biological changes. There are important structural changes in the brain that are distinct in normal aging, quote unquote, versus Alzheimer's disease.
So how does funding for research for Alzheimer's in particular compare to funding for other diseases in the U.S.?
Well, in the United States, we've actually just experienced a very nice surge in the research budget for Alzheimer's disease. I'm pleased to say that we will now approach $950 million. It's about $930 million in change in support of Alzheimer's research. That's still quite a bit shy of where we need to be. The National Alzheimer's Project Act, or NAPA, their panel of experts suggested that where we need to be to really start to make some impactful changes on the future of Alzheimer's disease is probably in the vicinity of $2 billion. Put that in contrast, we're still about a third, maybe as a fourth, the level of funding for, say, cancer in the United States, federally funded, supported research, that is.
Cancer gets something closer to in the billions.
In the billions. It's in the vicinity of 6 to 7 billion the last time I checked the figures. I do wish to interject here that I don't think that we want to increase Alzheimer's disease research funding at the expense of any of the other research areas. We must sort of raise all ships in a sense. And it's true that if we are able to increase the funding in support of Alzheimer's disease, we are going to be able to leave no stone unturned, as the philosophy states, where we are going to be able to go down certain paths of discovery to identify better ways to diagnose, better ways to treat, better ways to manage the behavioral symptoms for those caregivers that need it today.
So why is there such a big difference in funding, given that Alzheimer's affects so many people? Is it a stigma?
Stigma is certainly part of it. And perhaps in the United States, we're doing a little better than some other countries where mental illness is still very much a taboo. So there's certainly an element of that. But I think there's also a historical recognition that cancer came in the limelight sooner than Alzheimer's disease. It really took people who were in the limelight, like former President Ronald Reagan, Rita Hayworth, those people who did spend a fair amount of their time in the limelight, to have the diagnosis for people to go, oh, what's this about? And then they started to realize, oh, this is something that exists. This is something that's really devastating. And yet they were surprised to learn that the term was actually coined in around 1906.
But what's interesting there that you just said, and I definitely hadn't thought about, is that you can have sort of spokespeople for diseases like cancer or other diseases that get a lot of funding, whereas with Alzheimer's, I imagine it's hard to be a spokesperson if you're very severely affected by the disease.
Absolutely. And, you know, so the army of one is important. And so those folks that are caregivers or the patients themselves who are dealing with the early stages of the Alzheimer's disease, you know, I often get asked, how can they as an individual help address it? And one is to, you know, help separate fact from fiction. There are a lot of myths that promote stigma, frankly. And so what we have to do is try to undo some of that. We have to try to let people know, this is what we know, this is what we don't know. Here's where the areas of investment need to be. And let's bring people together, whether it's policymakers, whether it's the lay public. Let's bring people together around the issue of, well, we got to tackle it. And there's some organizations and universities and centers out there to try to address those very issues.
What are some of the myths or the biggest misconceptions about Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's disease is simply a manifestation of aging, for example. That is to say, everyone, if they live long enough, will develop Alzheimer's disease. I suppose in theory you could draw that and extrapolate that line out, and you might get there if we lived that long.
Uh-huh.
But in point of fact, there are very important differences between the two. You know, there are other myths that have come about that have been revealed, I should say, in certain surveys. For example, there are plenty of people out there that think that there is an accurate diagnostic tool currently, or there is an effective treatment out there for Alzheimer's disease. So when you have that mindset, why should it become of national importance or international importance? Because, gee, we already have a therapy out there. And in fact, that's not true. We have ways of potentially slowing it down for a period of time. But after that, the disease continues to move down its course of promoting degeneration and dysfunction. So those are some of the very significant myths that we've got to tackle. Other things I will say is a more general comment, and not everyone understands the importance of research or why certain universities need funding to support research, because they hear in the news, well, the NIH just got a $32 billion budget to do research, and believe it or not, there's thankfully a small subset of people who've actually come away with the interpretation that, well, NIH has got all this money. Why do universities need more money to do research? It must be all going on at the NIH. Again, I'm glad to say that that's not as common, but it has come up in some of my conversations with the public.
And what do you say about why it's necessary to have both?
So I do my best to communicate to them the importance of research, and also to communicate to them a philosophy that I certainly believe very strongly in. That is, it really is our privilege, not our prerogative, to do research in a particular area. And that privilege is endowed by the public's perception of a need to do research in that area. So we're cognizant of the fact that just because we have a topic of research that's very interesting, that that doesn't always justify our ability to do it. We have to be working towards treating human suffering, and this is one area where we have to really push hard.
So your lab at the UNT Health Science Center is involved in research on multiple levels, but one is looking at why many of Alzheimer's patients are women. So mm-hmm. what do you know about that?
So quite some time ago, we asked the question, why is it that women have about, depending on who you read, between 2 to 3 times higher prevalence of Alzheimer's disease than men? And one of the major biological changes that takes place across the lifespan in women that really doesn't have anything quite so comparable in men is the menopause. And following the menopause, there are two hormones that drop rather dramatically, and that's estrogen levels and progesterone levels. And we also started to appreciate in that time that these hormones, even though they may have been coined sex hormones, they extend their effects well beyond the strict confines of reproductive biology. And in fact, there's so many other parts of the body that are normal, natural targets of these hormones, including the bone, including the heart, and of course, the brain. So based on that information and knowing that in the United States, if women's lifespan on average is about 81 and the average age of the menopause is 51, and if you accept the premise that hormones like estrogen and progesterone normally target organ systems like the brain, what is it to live a third of your life in a hormone-deprived state? What is the consequence of that? And so we started to ask the question, is the loss of ovarian hormones like estrogen and progesterone a risk factor? I also want to be clear, I'm not suggesting that all women who go through the menopause are doomed to suffer the ravages of Alzheimer's disease. No, not at all. But what I am suggesting is for some women, it may be an important risk factor, just as much as smoking can be a risk factor for lung cancer. So I'm a big believer in the two-bucket theory of life. One bucket contains things you can control. The other bucket contains things you cannot. I cannot control the genetic cards I've been dealt. But what I can control is some of the behaviors, some of the other aspects of my life that may influence my risk. All that to say, we do need to look at this carefully. It may not be right for all women, but it may be important to identify that group of women that could benefit from estrogen or progesterone or the two together so as to mitigate a number of disease risks that increase after the menopausal period.
And so you're doing that research right now?
Yes.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. First, I want to remind people you're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. In this hour, we're talking about research on Alzheimer's disease, where we are and where we're headed. My guest is Dr. Sunny Singh, Dean of the Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences at the UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth. You can join our conversation today by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. We're happy to hear your questions about Alzheimer's and research going on at the UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking about Alzheimer's this hour with Dr. Sunny Singh. He's Dean of the Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences at the UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth. Now, there is no cure for Alzheimer's, but there are people trying to make a difference for the millions of Americans with the disease. And I profiled one woman, a Texas woman named Molly Meyer, who helps people living with Alzheimer's through poetry. And on the day I caught up with her, she was working with residents at the memory care unit at CC Young Retirement Community in Dallas.
Tell me a place that you've traveled, and then I'll ask the question and we'll kind of figure out how to put it in a poem. It could be any place.
She's dusting off old memories and using imagination to create poetry. Today, the theme is travel.
What is the first thing you think about when you think about London? Crowded streets?
Streets and all.
Noise?
Shopping.
In Meyer's workshops, she's traveled to several memory care units across the country. There are no wrong answers. When she asks about flags, a man hesitates before quietly speaking about a time he thinks he saw sailors waving flags from tall buildings.
Was that during World War II times?
Mm-hmm. That part of World War II.
That part of World War II, when people were coming back. Yeah. That's a beautiful image, and I want to put it in our poem.
Meyer is a trained poet, but the idea to use writing with Alzheimer's patients came from personal experience.
I lost both of my parents to Alzheimer's back to back, my dad in 2011, my mother in 2012. Safe to say it was not a very good time.
As her parents' memories declined, Meyer found it hard to empathize. Instead of trying to relate with them, she became frustrated.
You know, I didn't write poems with my parents, and I have that regret, but I regret not taking the time to just sit and ask questions, because I find that the people that I work with, especially in certain stages of the disease, are actually, I believe, more creative and more inventive and can travel in imagination.
Dr. Singh, is it really possible for people with Alzheimer's to recover lost memories or to improve?
I think there's certainly an opportunity for a certain level of improvement. But by and large, what we're dealing with is a disease that's progressive in nature. At the time of diagnosis, there's been a lot of pathology that has already taken place. It's estimated that the pathology's probably been going on for about 20 years prior to the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And here's the thing. If I were to put two brains up side by side, showing a normal brain and a brain with of a person with advanced or moderate Alzheimer's disease, what would jump out at you is that there's a pretty profound loss of nerve cells in the Alzheimer's brain. And here's the thing. The best behavioral treatment, the best drug treatment in the world is really unlikely to have much of an impact when the cells it's trying to help are no longer there. So that's part of the issue. But that's not to say that some of the drugs that we have on the market right now or some of the therapies that are being implemented, including trying to keep the brain active, using a variety of different strategies, those would resonate with different individuals, you know, whether it's art, whether it's music, whether it's hearing someone read a book to them, or the type of activity that we just heard. Those have the opportunity of reaching certain individuals to try to at least slow down the progression for a period of time. Unfortunately, the disease is still hanging on quite tightly, and the disease in its very nature is progressive. So after a certain point, even those types of treatments may no longer have a benefit.
You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372. Let's go to the phones now. Samra in Denton.
Hi.
Hi, Samra.
I have a slightly different question. I'm glad we're touching on this topic. I'm concerned with younger onset Alzheimer's. 4 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with younger onset Alzheimer's, but in retrospect, the symptoms were probably there 10 years ago. There was a good 10-year period there where he was treated for ADD, thyroid disorder, bipolar disorder, depression, you name it, and, of course, medicated for all of those conditions. So what is being done to help the medical community consider younger onset Alzheimer's as a possibility? Because there's this perception that it is a really old person's disease. And I mean, he just turned 66, so he's younger than a lot of people who are diagnosed with it. And also, Dr. Singh, is your research, particularly into things like blood tests, do you anticipate that being used to help find an early diagnosis for this before symptoms occur? Because it sure would have helped our life a whole lot if we'd have known about this sooner.
Thank you so much for your call. And let's, Dr. Singh, start with the first question, which is, what happens with misdiagnosis?
Unfortunately, that's a challenge that we're trying to overcome. So those are a really good set of questions. I appreciate the call. Indeed, Alzheimer's disease cannot be considered simply an old person's disease. And so it's not just people over the age of 70 that are afflicted with this disease. We're seeing diagnoses being made earlier and earlier. And I would like to suggest that that may not always altogether be a bad thing. Being able to diagnose the disease earlier, just as much as early diagnosis in cancer is likely to directly translate to better outcomes, I would suggest that that's also going to be true for Alzheimer's disease. The sooner we're able to detect it when the symptoms are mild at best, and maybe even the symptoms aren't even so overt or easily detectable, with the current tools that we have, but with the increase in sophistication of tools, including that blood test that our caller talked about, that's the work in no small part of Dr. Sid O'Bryant at our institution. He and his team have been working on this blood test. And to your point, the uniqueness of his trial that they're embarking on is going to take place in the primary care environment. You see, while dementia-specialized neurologists may be well-equipped to handle the questions, the identifying best strategies, best advice for the people who come into their clinics, the primary care community is much less adept at dealing with this. But yet, they are our front lines. So what Dr. O'Brien's work will do is, through a relatively simple blood test, identify those individuals at greatest risk and may even define the type of Alzheimer's disease. Let me take a quick moment to clarify what I mean by that. It's becoming clear that not all Alzheimer's cases are identical in terms of their pathology, in terms of their progression. All you have to do is put five people who are dealing with Alzheimer's disease in the same room, and they can probably share with you fairly diverse experiences in terms of how they developed into the situation they're in right now. And Dr. O'Brien and a number of other folks, myself included, recognize that there are certain subcategorizations of Alzheimer's disease that may help inform treatment. So, for example, once upon a time, people used to recognize depression as a byproduct of Alzheimer's disease. But we're starting to appreciate that depression, for some cases of Alzheimer's disease, may actually be part of the pathology. Similarly, metabolic dysfunction may also be a driver in certain populations, whereas what's called neuroinflammation, the processes that basically cause the immune system to be overly developed and actually contribute to dysfunction of the cells, that's the process we collectively refer to as neuroinflammation in a pathological sense. When that's overly driven, that can also lead to bad outcomes, but not for everyone. And again, one of the unique things that Dr. O'Brien described is the type of subset that drives Alzheimer's disease may be different in non-Hispanic Caucasians versus Mexican-American populations. So not only do we have to think about Alzheimer's disease in terms of separate little categories, but we also have to recognize that their diagnosis, or at least the factors that contribute to the development of Alzheimer's disease, may be different depending on the ethnic background.
Now, that sounds somewhat similar to what happened, and we were talking about funding and differences and how people recognize cancer as having a much higher level of funding for research. Cancer was at one point also thought to be maybe one disease.
Absolutely.
And there are hundreds of types.
There's so many different types, and we need to take a page from that playbook where we can learn from how, even in cardiovascular disease, there are specific subtypes, if you will, that can help inform treatment. Some of this may be enabled by genetic testing, so-called pharmacogenomics or pharmacogenetics. Mm-hmm. We see that already in breast cancer. Yeah. If a person has suspected breast cancer, they get a biopsy, and they may find out through that biopsy that, oh, it's estrogen receptor positive. In another case, it may be estrogen receptor negative. And the treatment varies as a function of that pre-screening. Similarly, what Dr. O'Brien's work will do is equip the primary care physician with a tool that would help the physician make the next recommendation, either make the referral, determine whether they need to go get a brain scan done, because if we try to do it brain scan first, we'll break the bank because it costs way too much, and right now it's all out-of-pocket costs. All that to say, it is very important that we deal with Alzheimer's disease not just as an old person's disease. And I think what is being done right now, we're not quite there yet, but hopefully in relatively short order, we will be able to equip our frontline defense in the medical community to deal with the silver tsunami that's coming down the pipeline.
So what would a blood test look for? How could it possibly determine whether someone was going to develop this disease?
That's a very good question, and it's a complex one. And what we've learned from measuring a variety of different things in blood, Dr. O'Brien certainly is a leader in this field, leading a major effort internationally on this particular topic, as well as standardizing the methodology associated with the blood assay. But what it would involve, so for example, in one of their papers published several years ago now, they identified about 30 or so proteins in blood, when you take together, has a very high predictive capacity for Alzheimer's disease. But more interestingly, he's starting to think, and a few of us as well, myself included, are starting to recognize that it's not just a diagnostic potential for this blood test, but it might also help us predict successful treatment. If you take the last 10 years of Alzheimer's drug trials, according to a definition that you have to see, 40% of your, 50% of your study group respond favorably to a drug trial, most of them, by that definition, failed. And unfortunately, the field that was tied to that drug trial dies a horrible death. But I think folks at the NIH, folks at the Alzheimer's Association, the research community as a whole are recognizing that, well, wait a minute. Even if we saw 5, 7, 10% of the study group respond favorably and the other 90% either didn't respond favorably or had a negative outcome, it wasn't a failure for that 5, 7, or 10%. What is it about the biology of those individuals that would help us predict a successful intervention? That's along the lines of what the application of Dr. O'Brien and his team's science will be, so that we can move more to this precision medicine initiative that is now part of the federally supported initiative of research.
And what phase is that research on the blood test at right now?
So they are about to embark on a clinical trial that will help validate the use of this in a primary care setting. This is going to be the first of its kind. The primary care setting is huge, and the standardization that's going to have to happen is going to be very, very important. And again, thanks to some of the work of a variety of people across the country, including at our own UNTL Science Center, people are becoming more and more cognizant of that standardization, because you don't want to have a measure at one location, let's say in Germany, and the same measurement in the United States, that just on the basis of its calibration, and that you'd think that this value is actually a normal in this group, but actually turns out to be in the pathology range in this other group.
So you have to standardize
You have to standardize that. And little things, how do you collect the sample? How do you store the sample? All those things have to be considered, and Dr. O'Brien is well on his way to addressing those issues.
So could there be specific tests for specific groups of people then?
I think that's what people are trying to determine through meaningful, informed, carefully done research. People are trying to identify what might be those subcategories of in Alzheimer's disease that would be paired up with a certain profile of blood proteins. So Mexican Americans, they apparently have a certain profile that would be that would lead us to think that they're more likely to develop the disease. Mm-hmm. Caucasians don't have the identical profile. So it's a matter of getting that information down. And again, it's this issue of we have to understand basic biology of the brain to then understand what goes wrong in pathology. And when you have those two together, can you make informed decisions about how best to diagnose and how best to treat?
It's interesting, though, because you get into tricky territory where you're coming up with specific diagnose tests for different people with different backgrounds or different genders, perhaps.
Yeah, I think the issue is that we have to not treat a disease. We have to treat arguably the individual. And I think that's in no small part what the Precision Medicine Initiative is about. Is that find those ways to define how one person's going to develop a disease, what are the risk factors for them, what are the risk factors for the others, and try to manage those risks in the best way we can. We used to do that with drugs. Once upon a time, pediatric and adult dosing may not have been thought to be so important. But lo and behold, now they are.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, research on Alzheimer's disease. We know you've got lots of questions. You can call with more, 800-933-5372, or email think at kera.org. We'll be back with more from Dr. Singh after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about Alzheimer's disease with Dr. Sunny Singh. He's dean at the UNT Health Science Center in Fort Worth. Dr. Singh, is it possible to prevent Alzheimer's?
Another great question.
I'm sure you get a lot.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to this issue, what I said earlier, this proverbial two-bucket theory of life. If you happen to fall within that category of Alzheimer's disease where it's driven by one of three causative genes, you cannot. If you live long enough, you will have either an absolute chance of getting the Alzheimer's disease, that is to say both your mom and your dad had a mutation, and you don't have a choice in that case, really. The lion's share of Alzheimer's cases, however, don't have causative genes associated with it. Rather, they have risk-promoting genes. And those risk-promoting genes, the most significant of which is something called ApoE or apolipoprotein E, depending on the type of ApoE gene you may have, among other genes, your risk could be increased. Certain behaviors or certain consequences, like head injury, for example, can also increase your risk for dementia. With that in mind, the answer to the question is, in some cases, it's inevitable. Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, that accounts for only about 5% of all Alzheimer's cases. The lion's share of Alzheimer's cases, you can do things to try to delay, prevent, protect the disease to a reasonable extent. And if there's one adage I would like our listeners to take home, is those strategies that are typically applied to keep your heart healthy are usually those same strategies that will keep your brain healthy. So that's among the things that you can do. Keep your brain active. You know, challenge yourself. It's not just doing Sudoku or crossword puzzles, but or reading, but it's to try to challenge yourself to do a little bit more over time. And it doesn't always have to be those types of activities that we usually think of as scholarly or something like that. But if you have grandkids, playing with your grandkids, because kids will definitely challenge you.
They'll wear you down.
They will wear you down. So I think there's so many different ways to keep yourself physically and mentally active. Those are certainly some of the strategies I would suggest.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Dorothy in Fort Worth. Or I'm sorry, Daylin in Fort Worth. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, of course.
Doctor, you mentioned Alzheimer's and a menopause connection to the estrogen depletion. And so my question is, should I, as a breast cancer survivor who was prescribed an estrogen blocker due to my ER-positive diagnosis, should I worry about an increased risk or being a part of one of those profile groups?
Oops, sorry. Great question. I want to make sure we have time to answer.
Thanks for that question. No, I think the data right now don't suggest that because you went, you had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, that your risk for Alzheimer's disease is going to be greater. What it does teach the medical community is that you're probably not a good candidate for receiving estrogen therapy as a way to modify your risk. Now, I should point out that estrogen therapy is not an FDA-approved treatment for the management of risk for Alzheimer's disease. It has a very fairly narrowed indication for its use. To the best of my knowledge, the fact that you had breast cancer and it was estrogen receptor positive doesn't put you at any greater risk for developing Alzheimer's disease.
So even though there's this connection between hormones and Alzheimer's, you can't tell someone, well, go and take or don't take hormones.
No, and you know, it's I recognize that it hormones are not going to be right for everyone. But what I don't want to do is rob women of options. If based on their biological profile, it is a worthy candidate to manage a whole host of things, including their bone health, heart health, brain health, and so long as they're using it in a responsible way with the advice of their physician, I think that's the reason to go forward with it. For any drug that a person considers, one has to manage the risk versus benefit equation. And if the risks start to outweigh the benefits, then it's time to consider something different. But by no means should we completely take that off the table, because for some women, it may indeed be a useful management of a variety of health-related issues after the menopause.
Now let's go to Dorothy in Fort Worth. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello. My question is, this disease runs in my family. My mother, my sister, some aunts have all had it. I'm 75, and should I take this test to see if I have a if I'm going to have it? And if I do that, how would that knowledge affect my future care or insurance or that sort of thing?
That's an excellent question. And in fact, bioethicists are, in fact, grappling with that issue, because even if we do have an accurate diagnostic test today, which, again, we do not have just yet, the question becomes, if the treatment field or the drug development field is lagging a little behind, what do we do? What do we tell the patient? Because you can imagine it's a tough thing to have to tell a patient that your symptoms are going to get worse and you're going to suffer from this debilitating disease, but we don't have anything quite to provide you yet. I should also clarify that the blood test is not yet available for the general public. It still has to go through this clinical trial, and at the earliest, if all things go well, we're talking about a 3 to 5 year time frame.
And someone wanted to know whether that clinical trial is open or have the volunteers already been selected?
No, they have not. They will be recruiting, we hope, soon. So as soon as that comes out, if any of your listeners want to contact the Health Science Center, we can try to get them in touch to see whether they are eligible to participate in the trial.
Great. Now, what is the connection, you touched on this earlier, between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's? That's part of your research.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So Down syndrome is attributed to having one extra copy of chromosome 21. And remember I talked about three causative genes. Well, those three causative genes are something called APP, or amyloid precursor protein, presenilin 1 and presenilin 2. Well, APP happens to be located on chromosome 21. So if you have three copies of chromosome 21, that means you've got an extra copy of the APP gene. Mm. And APP is the precursor for that bad protein we hear about called amyloid beta, or beta amyloid, depending on who you read. And so it's anticipated that a very significant proportion of people with Down syndrome, should they live long enough, will develop symptoms that resemble Alzheimer's disease. But again, trying to tease out what is it about their biology that would, whether it's through a blood test or whether through its cerebrospinal fluid, which is what people would get when they do a spinal tap, whether the factors that they're able to measure in there would predict the risk, the development, the conversion from a pre-Alzheimer's to an Alzheimer's. Because not everyone who has that early stage or pre-Alzheimer's, as some people might refer to it, actually convert to full-blown Alzheimer's disease. So again, the question becomes why? What was it about their biological makeup that made them either more at risk or less at risk for developing the disease? Those are all key questions that the field, folks at our institutions, but to certainly give credit to so many talented researchers out in the international, national community.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Joyce in Houston.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the program. I did want to know more about prevention, but what I understand is that, or I've come to think, that people I've known who are scientists, engineers, what have you, seem to have a higher population of them, like in that movie, Still Alice, of people who use their brain a lot. Is there a connection? I started programming computers in 1972, so I'm trying to, at 64, think about what do I do career-wise that might help prevent overuse of the brain, if that's a factor.
Interesting question.
So I don't. At least based on my reading, I don't think there is strong evidence to suggest that people who are highly educated are going to be more vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease. If anything, there may be an opposite association. But certainly one of the recommendations that my neurologist colleagues will certainly advocate for is to try to keep your brain active. Try to challenge yourself to do a little more. If you happen to read, you know, one book a month, maybe start reading three books over 2 months, that sort of thing. Keeping your brain active is important, but it's not the only thing that we can do. We can try to manage our blood lipids, make sure the cholesterol balance in our blood is good. And again, that theme of healthy heart, healthy brain comes to mind. Educate ourselves. There's so many excellent resources, whether it's universities in your backyard or the Alzheimer's Association, for example. They offer really great opportunities to help educate what are your risk factors, what to look out for, and should you have the unfortunate circumstance of having to deal with it firsthand, finding the resources available around you sooner than later.
So it's the holiday season, and a lot of people are with family members this time of year. What are some of the signs to look for in family members, whether they're younger or older, of Alzheimer's?
There are several. And again, I would welcome people to go on the Alzheimer's Association website, which is alz.org, and take a look at the top 10 signs that they have listed over there. But I think that's good from a couple of different perspectives. One is it helps people stay aware, be informed of what they should be looking out for, but it also helps them understand what Alzheimer's disease is not. Because if, you know, I get a common question about, hey, Sonny, you know, I forgot where my keys were this morning. Does that mean I have Alzheimer's disease? If that were true, I'd be in trouble. But yeah. The truth is, for many of those things, if we forget something but are able to remember it later, we're probably okay. We may need to just work up on how we remember things a little bit, some strategies.
If you forget where or how to drive to work, though,
yeah,
I hear that's a different thing.
That's a problem. Or if you're standing in front of your home or your loved one standing in front of their home and they have a key in front of their hand, they're not sure what to do with it. That's a problem. If they're starting to forget how to do things that they've always done very well, balance their checkbook, for example, those are all reasons to take it to the next level. But in order for this whole system to work, we do need to equip the primary care physicians with the knowledge base, with the skill set, and that's happening. It's happening at the grassroots level, where medical training is now infusing more and more of geriatric activity at our very own Health Science Center. We have Dr. Knabel, who's helping to infuse more geriatrics into the general curriculum. That hopefully will help down the road with primary care physicians being able to manage and refer appropriately.
So we often hear about how Alzheimer's disease robs loved ones of their memories and is really difficult for caregivers. What, if anything, do you see as a positive or as a lighter side of this disease?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
If there is a positive thing to the disease, I would have to say it's hitting home to more and more people, and it's requiring our nation, our world, because this is a disease that does not discriminate. It's an equal opportunity devastator. And that awareness that accompanies seeing the diagnosis, seeing it hit home, without it requiring the 3 degrees of separation. But by and large, we can all probably have a conversation and say, at best, we have 1 degree of separation that separates us from a person dealing with the ravages of Alzheimer's disease. That, unfortunately, has required us all to realize we're all dealing with something really bad. But the positive in that, it's allowed us to have a much more impact on policymakers so that they're aware that we got to do something and we got to do it now.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, we were talking with Dr. Sonny Singh with UNT Health Science Center about Alzheimer's. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.